before they could attack. This woman was human, and clearly from this world. Her name tag said, J. Kim. The face made the hunter stop in her tracks. She stared at the terrified, desperate face of the woman. "Jiwoo," murmured the hunter. The woman gaped up at her with eyes that were filled with madness.
"Please, please don't."
The hunter took a small step forward and began reaching out a gloved hand.
"Your name is Jiwoo Kim," she said, "isn't it?"
"My God, Jiwoo."
At that, the woman screamed and fled. The hounds watched her go, plunging into the green hell. The leaves closed around her, but the echo of her scream seemed to fill the air for many seconds, and then it ended with an awful abruptness.
"Jiwoo,"
said the hunter again, feeling confusion and sadness pulling at her. This world, this accursed version of reality, was so achingly close to her own. In her own reality, long gone now, there had been a Jiwoo Kim too. And there, as here, the demons of the threshold had ruined her and stolen first her mind and then her life. The hunter's hand clutched the spear with such force it hurt the bones in her fingers. Another reminder of what Abby Corman had stolen from her. She spun and headed for the exit, moving faster and faster. And by the time she reached the far end of the jungle, she was running. The centipede she carried had very little of its acid left, and the hunter had to gut it and squeeze each part of the segmented body in order to attack the seals on the security door. Even with that acid, it took all her strength, amped up by the servo mechanisms in her armor, to bash her way through and into the hall, which, of course, was empty. She ignored the elevators. They only worked in less than 1 in 20 of the versions of the world. The stairs could not malfunction, and she knew that Abby Corman, all of the Abby Cormans, were crafty. This one had to be the shrewdest of all, because this was the true mother of none. A fractured or polluted brilliance that needed to be stopped, but could never be underestimated. At the top of the stairs, she looked down, seeing that different floors were darker on this side of the building than the other. Odd. She had vague and ugly suspicions as to why. Chapter 32. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. Mike Castro got to his feet and staggered over as David Bailey jumped lightly down from the shattered window. It took a moment to register that David wore a mountain climbing harness, with pitons clanking at his belt.
"Oh,"
Castro began, and then suddenly flung himself at the man, gathering him into a fierce bear hug. David endured it for 2 full seconds and then pushed him back.
"Where's Dr. Corman?" he demanded.
I don't know.
"Who are you?"
"Mike Castro, building security. I came up with Abby when she got here. We got stuck in the elevator and..."
"She said she was on the 53rd floor," interrupted David. "Is that where she is now?"
Castro was having a hard time rebooting his conversational awareness. He shook his head like a wet dog and gave it another try.
"She went into the fire tower with Rosa and a few others. Do you know Rosa?"
"Yes, Abby's best friend,"
David said as he swapped the nearly spent magazine for a fresh one.
"Which tower? Show me."
As they turned to go, they saw 2 people step tentatively out from behind a section of the gateway machine. A pale red-haired woman and a man with a Sikh's turban. Both had bloodstains on their clothes. Both had deep shock in their eyes.
"Are you the police?" asked the man. "Are you SWAT?"
"What?"
asked David, surprised.
"No. No, I'm Abby Corman's boyfriend."
The tech looked past him at the window, as if expecting a fully armed team.
"Is SWAT coming? Who else is coming to help us? When will SWAT be here?"
His voice had the cadence of the psychologically disconnected. The woman with him had a hand over her mouth and seemed incapable of any kind of speech.
"Is that SWAT?"
said someone else, and they turned as more people emerged from hiding. 7 in all. One of them, a short man with cuts on his face, held a pair of heavy-duty screwdrivers in his fists. His clothes were torn, and it was clear he'd been fighting someone, or something.
I'm not SWAT, David said loud enough for them all to hear. I came to help Abby.
Are the police coming?
Asked the man with the screwdrivers. His name tag said Guzman.
I don't know, said David. It's a mess out there.
Out where?
Asked Guzman.
Outside, said David.
And immediately all of them, except the redhead, hurried to the window and stared out at the city. David and Castro joined them. The night sky was filled with helicopters, but below them, large parts of the city were burning, and some of it, whole blocks of skyscrapers, were gone. Simply gone.
That's impossible, said Guzman. The threshold isn't here. The things that came out of it are in here.
David quickly explained about the pulses and how each one seemed to warp the city, perhaps warping the fabric of reality. David was no scientist, but he'd seen a lot of science fiction movies. He'd seen special effects do on screen what he'd now witnessed firsthand. He turned away from the window and walked around the machine, staring at the device that had done so much damage. He didn't see the actual threshold until he walked nearly around the whole of the gateway. Then he stopped and stared. His stomach turned to ice as he looked through a hole in the universe. Beyond it, a few feet from where he stood, was a beach made of green glass. David could feel the heat as it shimmered up from the sand, if it was sand at all. Beyond the sand, maybe 100 yards from where he stood, was another machine. It was exactly like the one that filled this room, except it wasn't the same. This one was even bigger, 2 or 3 times the size. It vibrated and hummed and sent waves of energy, pulses, out in all directions. And to David, it felt somehow alive. That was the only word that described it. Alive. He could feel it, sense it. He knew it to be true. This other gateway machine was actually alive. It throbbed, breathed, lived. But that was only part of what he saw. There was something much worse in that other world. As troubling as that gateway machine was, it shrank to insignificance by what hung in the air above it. An impossible thing. It stood there, miles high, dominating the sky. It was a creature, maybe the god of this world. Its legs were like towers, like skyscrapers, and the body was vaguely humanoid. But the head, David sank to his knees, and his pistol fell from his slack fingers. The enormous monster's face was covered by thousands of wriggling feelers that knotted and twisted like gigantic gray-green tentacles. The creature tore at the air with scaly claws that looked like they could slash through plate steel, and behind it, stretching out from its back, were leather wings. The sight of it was worse than anything David had so far seen. It tore at his mind. He beheld something that could not be, a god from some nightmare universe. The godlike creature threw back its head, and from that mouth, hidden by those writhing tentacles, came a roar so impossibly loud that it shattered the ground on which it stood. Vast pillars of lava leapt up and covered the landscape with smoke and fire. And then it was gone. The whole world was gone. The green sand and that living machine and the towering god, gone. In its place was an island of swamps and trees through which creatures moved that were like dinosaurs, but not any David had ever seen. Some as large as whales, others small as robins, and above them, the sky was filled with enormous, scaly bats. That world vanished too, replaced by another, and another, and another.
My God, he said softly. Abby, what have you done?
Chapter 33. The Pierce Tower. Security Communications Office, 41st floor. The careful pace Sloan and her two protectors set out with changed as they made their way down. On the 56th floor was another fire axe, and Chan took that. When they saw a third on 54, Chan offered to get it for Sloan, but she withered him with a cold look, and they left the tool in place. The stairwell was empty, and soon they were running. Far above them, sounds filled the air. Strange, commingled, sounds of things breaking, metal and concrete, yells and screams,
some of which were in English, some in languages none of them had ever heard, and animal sounds, cries and barks and hisses. Sloane desperately needed to rest, but comfort could wait, and at least her head and legs worked. But the descent was wearing on her. It made her bruised knees feel like they were on fire, and her head pounded constantly. As if reading her mind, Broussard said,
"We're almost there, Doc."
"Almost where? We're still more than halfway up this fucking tower."
"No," said Chan. "He's right. This is good."
"What are you two idiots talking about?" Sloane demanded.
Broussard explained,
"Look, Doc, there's a security communications office on 41. If the door isn't locked and we can get in, I think they have guns in there. And I know for sure that's where they monitor the surveillance cameras for all the floors."
"Communications," echoed Sloane. "Will they be able to reach outside?"
"I think so," said Broussard. "I mean, they'd have to, even in a lockdown. Someone has to communicate with first responders if there's a situation here."
She leaned over the rail and looked down.
"What's the protocol for a lockdown? Won't they already have called for help?"
God, I hope so, said Broussard. "But either way, we need to call, too. The security team can't explain to anyone what's happening here. You can."
Sloane chewed her lip for a moment, then gave a decisive nod.
"Then let's get down there."
The big man nodded and began descending the steps. Chan was a single step behind Sloane. They went slower, but they made it to the 41st floor landing without incident. Broussard began to reach for the door, but stopped as a sound came rising up from below. And not far below. It sounded as if it came from somewhere on 40, but muted, as if it drifted from deep inside the suite of offices down there, drifting through a door unwisely left open. The sound riveted them to the spot. It was so strange, so unnerving, like the cry of a seagull riding the wind over a beach, plaintive and lonely. But the tonal quality was dreadfully close to that of a child. The sound cut through Sloane, not because of the childlike quality, which was likely what struck Broussard and Chan, but because she had heard it before. She'd seen what made that sound, and it was neither a bird nor a child. That sound came to her in dreams on many nights, on those nights when she didn't or couldn't drink herself into dreamlessness. It was a sound that she'd heard on that terrible day in Fukushima when the last gateway was opened.
"Christ on the cross," she breathed.
"What is that?" whispered Chan.
"It's nothing," she lied.
The men stared at her, but before they could ask anything more, she walked over to the door to the security floor, then paused. Dr. Benjamin had explained that adding her to the tower's complex identification protocols was enormously difficult and time-consuming, requiring review and approval by the House Oversight Committee. However, he said, it was a workaround that was detected a year ago. It allowed for the left-hand thumbprint to be used in cases where the standard print, the right thumb, was unavailable. This had been instituted when Benjamin's secretary had broken her thumb and three fingers skiing and had to add her left thumb in order to get into the building. It was never required that all staff members logged their left thumbprints, and so Benjamin entered Sloane's into Abby Corman's file. Otherwise, the data, name and ID number, were still Abby's. This little trick of Arnold Benjamin's was crucial because a thumbprint was necessary to access the gateway firing controls. Now, Sloane knew, it was also a free pass through any door in the Pierce Tower. The lights on the small box beside the door were lit, and the entry light was a solid red. She pressed her left thumb on the sensor, and the red light flickered for a moment and then winked out, to be replaced by a luminous green. The door lock clicked. Chan stepped past her to pull the door open, and he and Broussard peered inside. Sloane stood on tiptoes to look between their heads and saw a rather mundane hallway running the length of the floor between rows of closed office doors. There was no one in sight and nothing out of the ordinary. No movement, no sound.
"Looks good," said Broussard cautiously as he stepped inside, creeping like a burglar, the fire axe held in both hands.
Chan, equally armed, stayed by Sloane's side when she entered.
"Where's the security office?" she asked.
"End of the hall," said Broussard.
He led the way, walking very carefully. His shoes made no sound at all on the gray industrial carpeting. He paused at each of the office doors. Most were locked. Three were unlocked. But the first was a supply closet. One was a copy room. And the third was a generic office with three desks, all empty. Then they reached the last door, which was made of shatterproof glass stenciled with security communications, authorized access only.
"You're up, Doc," suggested Chan. And again she used her thumbprint on the sensor.
The locks clicked, and they stepped inside. Broussard left Chan with Sloane while he made a quick search of the inner offices. He called, "All clear," and they found him down a short side corridor. On one side was a locked room labeled Armory, and on the other was Communications. Sloane used her thumb on the Armory door, not really expecting it to work, but it did, and they hurried inside. The gun cabinets, however, had no sensors and were securely locked.
"I got this," said Broussard, hefting his axe. "Tom, why don't you take the doc to the other room and see if you can get someone on the line? There's not enough room to swing this thing if you're here."
"Make it quick," Sloane said.
The muscles at the corners of Broussard's jaw twitched, but he said nothing. As soon as Sloane and Chan left the room, they heard a whistling whoosh and the first heavy chunk as the big man attacked the gun cabinet. In the other room, they found a row of walkie-talkies standing in charging stations. Chan took one and clicked the send key.
"Calling any security in the building," he said. "This is Thomas Chang. I'm with Dr. Sloane. We're in the comm center on 41. Anyone there?"
They leaned together as he released the key, but all they heard was empty white noise.
"Shit," snapped Sloane.
She spotted a landline, but when she put the receiver to her ear, all she got was a soft, pulsing buzz. It sounded like an open line. She was about to hang it up, when she thought she heard something.
"Is someone there?"
The buzzing continued, but for a moment it faded out, and there was a noise that sounded like breathing, heavy and slow. She gestured for Chan to listen too.
"This is Dr. Sloane," she said. "Is anyone there?"
The breathing continued for a few moments. Then it changed, and all the hair on Sloane's arms rose straight up as the breathing turned to sobs. The room seemed to go 20 degrees colder. Chan's face turned waxy pale, but then the line went totally dead, no sound at all.
"Okay," said Chan. "That was freaky as fuck."
Sloane said nothing as she returned the phone to the cradle. Her nerves were completely shot, but she kept her face composed. That took tremendous effort. But as deeply disturbing as all of this was, she'd be damned if she would show fear in front of Chan or that black man. They searched the office, opening cabinets and desk drawers, looking for cell phones or anything, and then Chan gave a small cry of triumph.
"Oh, hell yes," he said, holding up a satellite phone.
Chapter 34. The Pierce Tower, 22nd floor. Abby and Rosso raced down floor by floor. They passed through several landings where the lights were out, and on each of those, they paused only long enough to flip up the plexiglass covers next to the doors and punch the big red lockdown buttons. However, on several floors, they encountered other survivors, technicians, the secretary from the security office, and a wild-eyed janitor who kept muttering to himself in a voice so low no one could understand what he was saying. Any hopes Abby had of finding out that the dimensional warping was confined to the upper stories were dispelled. The survivors were all ragged, shocked, injured, and often the last living members of small groups. Each had a horror story to tell, but Abby had no time to listen. She explained their mission, and the others fell in with her. Maybe they did not understand the science of it, but they all grasped the urgency, even the janitor. By the time they reached the 23rd floor, there were 32 survivors. The strongest of them, men and women, carried fire axes they took from various landings. No one had a handgun, though the secretary produced a stun gun from her purse. She was a middle-aged woman with blue-gray hair and too much makeup, but her eyes were less jumpy than most of the others.
Do you know how to use that? Asked Rosa as they continued descending. The secretary, whose name was Joy, gave her a withering smile. Honey, I did 2 tours in Afghanistan and now I live in Mudhaven. What do you think? Rosa nodded. Yeah, well, I bet you'd be happy to be back in the Bronx right now. Joy gave her a look, one wise eyebrow raised. Right now, I'd be happy to be at a Taliban rally in Kabul, anywhere but here. Breach. They finally reached the 22nd floor, and there they stopped. There was no one on the landing, and no one in the hall near the elevators. There was, however, something on the floor. A trail that glistened wetly beneath the fluorescent lights, a couple of feet wide. Abby turned and saw that the trail came up the steps from below, from the unlighted 21st floor. It crossed where they were standing, and everyone shuffled aside so as not to stand on it. The trail went to the doorway and vanished inside. The door itself, the massive slab of reinforced steel alloy, lay on the floor, crumpled as completely as if it were a discarded beer can. There were no lights burning on the other side of that doorway. Everything was drenched in dark shadows. A stink like rotting fish wafted out, making them gag. And from deep within that fetid darkness came an awful, ugly sound. 2 sounds, really. One was the same rasping sound they'd heard before, like heavy pieces of wet leather being rubbed together. The other sound, even more chilling, was a voice. It spoke slowly, thickly. It said, "Help me. I hurt myself. Come here and help me." Those same 10 words, over and over again. But the voice was wrong. There was absolutely nothing about it that sounded human. Nothing at all. Chapter 35. The Pierce Tower, 41st floor. The sight of the satellite phone tore a sound from Sloane that was halfway between a gasp of delight and a sob. She snatched it from Chan and walked away from him, holding up a hand to keep him from following. She went all the way over to a corner of the room, where one of the steel shutters had dropped down to obscure the window. It took effort to recall the number, even though it was something she'd used a few times before. Not recently, though. Not since Fukushima. She closed her eyes and listened to a series of clicks and beeps, and then abruptly, a voice said, "Station?"
"Station 8154,
said Sloane, giving the ID code assigned to her years ago. There was a pause, and then a different voice came on the line.
"Is this a secure line?" asked the voice.
Sloane could picture the face that went along with that voice, heavy features with a sharp nose, strong chin, an almost Neanderthal brow, and high cheekbones. Eyes as blue as a summer sky, and a cruel, hard mouth. Anton Kruger, a very special operator for a department within the government that had no badge, no insignia, and no official name.
"I don't know," said Sloane. "I'm calling from the security office at the Pierce Tower in New York."
"Shit," said Kruger. "I knew it. Everything around that part of Manhattan is in the goddamn Twilight Zone. Fuck me to tears. I knew this had to be you. Is this what I think it is?"
Her mouth had gone totally dry, and she had to work up enough spit to manage a single word.
"Yes."
A pause. "How bad?"
"Bad."
"Is there a threshold?"
"Yes."
"Is it open?"
"Yes."
"Is it stable?"
"No."
"Has anything come through?"
Sloane closed her eyes.
"Yes, it's bad. It's very bad."
Another beat.
"Can you close the threshold?" asked Kruger.
Sloane took a breath.
"Not without help. I can't get to it."
Can you get out of the building? It's in a full lockdown, so no.
A much longer pause, and she could hear muffled conversation in the background, but couldn't make out any of the words. Then Kruger came back on the line. I'll bring a team. And the line went dead. Chapter 36. The Pierce Tower, 22nd floor.
No, no way. No fucking way. No, 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 no.
It was the janitor who spoke. He was one of the axe wielders, and he dropped his weapon and began backing toward the stairs. But Riley, of all people, moved to block him.
Pick it up, he said, nudging the axe with his sneakered toe. No way, said the janitor. I'm done. I can't. I just can't. Pick it up, growled Riley, putting a surprising edge into his voice.
The janitor shook his head and kept moving backward. Riley squatted and snatched up the axe and held it out to the man.
Take it, he said. Come on, take it back.
Take it back,
cried the janitor, a note of hysteria creeping into his voice, driving it two octaves higher.
Take it back, take it back. You take it back. Take it all back. This is your fault. You freaking scientist. Mad scientists.
A fractured laugh bubbled out of him, high and weird and wrong.
That's what you are, a bunch of mad scientists. You did this to us. You and your freaking, whatever you're doing up on 58. Don't say that it's not you. Mad scientist, all of you, all of you. You killed all of my friends, everyone I worked with. You killed us all. You know that, right? We're all going to die. No one's getting out of here alive. No one.
Riley took a step toward him, still offering the axe, but the man would not touch it. He was in the fire tower entrance now, sweaty hands gripping the frame.
Bill, said Abby, that's your name, isn't it? Bill? Yes, this is our fault. An experiment went badly wrong. I admit it. We all admit it, but we're about to fix it. This room has controls that can reset everything. We can put it back the way it was. We can fix this.
Bill goggled at her. His mouth writhed, trying on different versions of bad smiles, but each one wouldn't take and slid off. He pointed at the slime trail.
Fix this? Jesus H. Christ, Dr. Corman. You can't fix this. No one can fix this. How are you going to fix that? How are you going to fix what happened to Diego and Andy and Tyrese? Are you going to go up to the 30th floor and try to put them back together again? Well, good luck, because I don't think you're going to find all the goddamn pieces. You sure as hell never going to find Tyrese's head. No, ma'am. No, sirree, Bob. You won't find that sure as God made little green fucking apples.
With that, he snaked out a hand and ripped the axe from Riley's grip, jerking it with such force that the young tech stumbled and dropped to his knees. Bill raised the axe as if he was going to chop Riley in the head. Then another of those twisted laughs bubbled out of him. It turned into a sob, and he spun drunkenly and charged back into the fire stairs. They heard him pounding his way up. Rosa caught Riley under the armpit and pulled him to his feet. They all listened to the janitor's footfalls fading and fading, and then finally disappearing. They never found out how far he got. They never saw him again. Abby looked down at the axe in her hands. It felt oddly heavy, as if she'd been carrying it her whole life. Turning felt like she was pushing through a wall of mud. During the winter months, when it was bitterly cold outside, too frigid to walk the four blocks to the gym, she and Rosa would put on sweats and walk from the ground floor up to 58 and back down, sometimes twice. That was sweaty fun. Now the sweat on her body felt like cold grease, and the journey from 58 down here to 22 seemed like it had burned years off her life and withered her down to a husk. Abby walked past the others, who were staring at either her or the empty stairwell. She stopped in front of the open doorway. Without turning to the others, she said, I'm tired. There was a murmur that faded out very quickly. I'm really tired of running. She adjusted her grip on the axe. I'm not running anymore. And with that, she stepped inside and was swallowed by darkness. Chapter 37. The Pierce Tower, 41st floor. Dr. Jacqueline Sloan watched as her two bodyguards shoved desks and file cabinets in front of the door. She did not help them. It wasn't her responsibility. This was minion work, and they seemed to be doing an acceptable job. She stood at the entrance to the security office, a satellite phone pressed to her chest, watching. Every now and then, the two men stopped as a sound came from outside. Not just outside the office, but a couple of times outside the building itself. Massive, heavy sounds, as if something very big struck the tower. Not like a helicopter crashing into the building, nothing metallic like that. These sounds were strangely heavy and soft. The word organic floated through Sloane's mind, but she did not speak it aloud. From elsewhere in the building came more specific sounds, screams, male and female, and other. Maybe animal, but none of them knew which kind of animal. They heard gunshots, too, but they were small arms fire, spaced shots, not the staccato bursts of automatic rifles. Besides, it was too soon for Kruger's team to be here. Each time Chan and Broussard stopped to listen, Sloane simply said, "Keep working." And strangely, they did. As the minutes burned away, and the world beyond those walls became progressively stranger. Chapter 38. The Pierce Tower, 58th floor. The gateway room stood empty, though not really. Abby Corman was gone. So were Arnold Benjamin and Jacqueline Sloan. The techs and support staff were gone, leaving only the dead behind. The hunter and her pack were gone. David Bailey and Mike Castro and the other survivors were gone. The centipede was gone, and the other creatures had fled down the stairs or out the shattered windows. But the room was not empty of movement. It was not empty of life. The threshold shimmered and changed, as if God kept blinking, looking at world upon world upon world, not through the infinity of space or even time, but of dimensional reality. Since Sloane and Benjamin had fired the machine, it had cycled through 16,211 worlds. The speed of the cycling varied from long glimpses of 10 or 15 seconds to snatches of images that shifted fast as a hummingbird's wings. Dead worlds, burning worlds, ancient worlds, primeval worlds, earths in which humanity had long since evolved and left for the stars, abandoning the tired and barren husk of their mother planet, earths in which no asteroid had struck the Yucatan Peninsula, in which the dinosaurs never became extinct and had instead evolved, earths in which different species had fought and won the battle for survival. There were earths where civilizations of rats and cockroaches and birds and reptiles built cities so exotic there were no adjectives in human languages to describe them. There were earths in which the trees themselves had learned to speak in languages made up of 10 million subtle variations of leafy friction. There were earths that had never cooled from their tumultuous volcanic birth pangs, and earths where glaciers did not last for ages, but for millions of years. There were earths of unparalleled beauty, where cultures that aspired to the pinnacle of reason and art and subtlety of thought, and earths where even children celebrated the number of their kills rather than the number of their years. Infinite earths, in an infinity of probability and possibility, earths without counting, in a universe defined by its own limitlessness. Most often, the threshold was not stable long enough for more than a breeze or a blown leaf or a firefly to dart through. But there were moments when creatures attacked the hole in the world, leaping by madness or hunger or reflex at the strange thing that appeared in their experience, leaping at and falling into, through. When the threshold paused long enough in such worlds, things came through. 16,211 worlds. 16,212. 16,213. Chapter 39. The Pierce Tower, 38th floor. Dr. Arnold Benjamin flew down the stairs with the three security guards. Bernie, the short, squatty one. Sally, the woman with the pro wrestler's face and neck tattoos. And Mark, the ex-Marine shift commander with the brush cut and lantern jaw. Bernie was on point, a combat shotgun in his thick hands. There was a small mag light fixed beneath the barrel, and it cut through the shadows on those floors where the lights were out. Sally, tailing behind, had an identical gun, and Mark held a long-barreled flashlight in his left hand with the wrist of his gun hand resting atop it. They moved with the cool, unemotional precision of professionals, and it calmed Benjamin. However, as they went down, floor by floor, they asked him what was going on, and the more he told them, the more uncertain they became. Finally, on the 38th floor, the three officers simply stopped and stared at him.
"Excuse me for saying this, Doc," said Mark, "but either you're bullshitting us or you've lost your goddamn mind."
"I wish it was one or the other," said Benjamin.
"But, God, man, haven't you seen what's going on?"
"We heard some weird stuff," said Sally.
"Heard, sure,"
said Mark, leaning a hip against the metal banister.
"But we haven't seen shit. I mean, sure, we knew something was up because the building went into lockdown and the power was out for a while. There were those energy waves."
"Dimensional pulse waves," said Benjamin.
"Yeah, okay, those. And we heard some screams, but everywhere we went to look, there was nothing, nobody. The radios are out and the cell service is shit. We tried getting into the comm center on 41, but the door's locked and barricaded. We thought maybe this was some kind of terrorist attack. You know, someone hacked the building systems, took out the comms and like that. So we geared up and went on patrol. But now you're telling me about aliens and doorways and giant centipedes?"
He gave a half smile and shook his head.
"I don't want to lose my job here, but..."
"I know how it sounds," snapped Benjamin, "but it's true. What do you think we do here anyway?"
"It's way above my pay grade to even think those thoughts."
Benjamin winced at that. It was more or less what he told Mark 2 years ago, when the officer casually asked what went on up on 58.
"And," added Mark, "I have to say it's a little hard to swallow."
"I'm not asking you to swallow anything," said Benjamin frostily. "I'm telling you what it is and ordering you to get me down to the 22nd floor so I can save all of our asses and fix this thing."
The three guards glanced at each other, then back at him.
"And you can fix it?"
"Yes."
"No bullshit?"
"No bullshit,"
said Benjamin, and even put a smile on his face.
"Abby Corman may have caused this, but trust me when I say that I alone can fix it."
"And there really are monsters?" asked Bernie.
"Well, not like vampires or werewolves, no, but monsters of a kind. Species unknown to the science of this world. Rather interesting from a certain perspective, and might become an actual field of study if we can sort all this out and get Gateway back on track. A new branch of exobiology, science of the unknown."
Mark frowned.
"You sound happy about it."
"Happy? No. But the scientist in me is aware of the exciting opportunities. Didn't you say people got killed up there? That kid Connor and some others?"
Benjamin's smile flaked off.
"There are always risks in real science. Discovery of any kind is dangerous. Ask Captain Cook."
"Who?"
"Never mind. We need to get moving."
But the guards did not move. Mark still leaned against the rail.
"And when you say monsters, Dr. Benjamin, you really expect us to believe all this?"
Benjamin stiffened.
"What's that supposed to mean? I just told you."
"I know," said Mark,
But really, aliens and high-tech armor and all the rest, you have to admit that it's a lot to...
He never finished. A massive gray tentacle, thick as an oak tree, whipped up out of the central stairwell, wrapped itself around his body, and then jerked him over the rail and down. Bernie and Sally fell backward, their shotguns falling from their hands, their screams following Mark down into the darkness. Chapter 40. Over New York airspace, two unmarked black UH-60M Black Hawk helicopters punched through the sky at close to 200 miles an hour, pushing the muscular General Electric engines to their top range. The Halos were equipped with ESSS stub wings provisioned with Hydra 70 unguided rockets and AGM-114 Hellfire missiles. Each bird had two flight crewmen and two loadmasters who doubled as door gunners for the M134 miniguns, and seated on benches were 10 soldiers, 20 top-tier special operators, including First Sergeant Anton Kruger. Kruger's team was kitted out with high-end body armor and ballistic helmets, with sophisticated comms units hardened against hacking and EMPs. They were heavily armed and laden with extra magazines, several kinds of grenades, explosives, and tactical computers. When it came to bloody combat in all of Earth's environments, none of them was a virgin. They were calm, hardened, professional soldiers working for a no-name department that only hired the very best. There was nothing they hadn't done or hadn't seen. Until now. As the Halos crossed from Jersey into New York airspace, they first leaned forward and then crowded the windows, staring in growing horror and astonishment. The briefing had been blunt and strange, but nothing, not any kind of intelligence sharing, could have prepared them for this. New York City wasn't New York City anymore. It was wrong, twisted, broken, burning, and overrun. Kruger leaned over the minigun and felt his jaw sag open. Beside him, someone said, "God save my soul." It was the only thing anyone said, the only thing any of them could manage. The helicopters flew into hell. Chapter 41. The Pierce Tower, 22nd floor. A strange, plaintive voice repeated its call. Abby held the axe in both hands as she crept into the room. There was no light at all inside, and what little spilled in from the hall did nothing to push back the inky darkness. It felt like going blind. The intensity of the blackness somehow made the axe feel like a fragile toy in her hands. "Where are you?" she called. Though something told her that the voice was not what it seemed, that it was a lie, a trick, a trap. But she kept going, step by step, the axe ready, though her hands were slick with fear sweat. A muffled confusion of sounds behind her told Abby that the others, at least some, were following. She hoped Rosa was one of them, but if this was too much for her or any of the others, Abby could understand. She sure as hell did not want to be here. Not within 1,000 miles of here. She knew the layout of the backup control room as well as anyone, and better than most. It had been built according to her designs. She'd once joked that so much of the building came from her imagination that she could find her way through it blindfolded. A minor joke then, but now it felt like a prophecy. One of the bad kinds from old Greek myths, the kind where things go wrong and only get worse. She crept forward, visualizing the layout. The door to the backup control suite was close. 20 more steps. There were flashlights in there too, and satellite phones. 20 steps, and she could start the procedure that would shut down the gateway machine, close the threshold, and... The lights suddenly flared on, all of them at once. Every ceiling light, every desk light, bang, on. The glare bashed her, stabbed her through the eyes with such intensity, there was sharp physical pain. "Christ, Rosa," she yelled. "Did you do that? God, warn me next time." "No," said a voice,
and it froze her. Shielding her eyes with one hand, she peered at the figure standing right there, right at the door to the control suite. The hunter.
Help me. I hurt myself. Come here and help me.
The words came from the hunter, a recording of some kind. It was no consolation to Abby that she'd suspected it was a setup. It's hard to take comfort from walking into a trap. Soft, ugly sounds made her turn, and she saw, positioned all around the room, crouching and baring their wicked teeth, the Hellcats. They surrounded Abby's party, their reptilian eyes burning with hate and hunger.
Abby Corman, mother of none, said the hunter, destroyer of worlds. After all these years, all these worlds, I have you.
Abby took her axe in both hands again, raising the blade a bit, pointing it at the hunter. Why do you keep calling me that?
It's your name, said the hunter.
No, the other thing. Destroyer of worlds? I haven't destroyed anything. The hunter stepped quickly forward, almost close enough to touch. Her pack hissed.
You have destroyed everything. Countless worlds. Trillions of lives spread throughout the dimensions. No one in the history of any world has slaughtered as many, destroyed as much.
You're wrong, yelled Rosa, hurrying up to step between this monster and her friend. Abby didn't do this. The blow that struck Rosa was so hideously fast that she never had time to block or duck. It was a cruel backhanded strike across her face, hitting her so hard it spun her and knocked the light from her eyes and dropped her face down on the floor. Abby screamed and dropped to her knees beside Rosa, not sure if she was alive or dead.
You're the monster, she yelled. Yes, said the hunter, I am a monster. I am the monster you made of me.
Abby dropped her axe and pulled Rosa against her, cradling the limp body. The Hellcats drew closer to the group of technicians. Death itself seemed to hold them all in its cold hand and was slowly closing its fingers.
The monster that I made of you? Asked Abby in a fragile voice that nevertheless still held an edge of defiance, even now.
What are you talking about? You don't even know me. The hunter took another step closer, looming over Abby.
I don't know you. Is that what you say?
Then the alien reached up and touched concealed buttons on the side of her helmet. There was a hiss of gas, and then the hunter lifted it off her head and let the helmet fall to the floor. Abby stared in horror at what she saw. The face was human, the face of an old woman. Her skin was a faded medium brown, wrinkled and crisscrossed with many scars. One eye was bleached to an egg whiteness, but the other burned with green fire.
Yes, said the hunter. I know you.
The voice, no longer filtered through the helmet's comm system, was terrifyingly familiar, as was that green eye and the face itself. Abby stared in shock and horror, seeing through the age and damage, seeing the real face of the hunter, seeing her own face. The hunter was Abby Corman. End of part two. To be concluded in Bewilderness, Destroyer of Worlds.
This has been an Audible original, produced by Audible Originals, written by Jonathan Mayberry, performed by Shayna Small, executive producers Steve Feldberg and Joy Smith, acquisition and development Louise Quayle, vice president of Audible Studios Mike Charzik, editor-in-chief, Audible Original Publishing, David Blum. Copyright 2020 by Jonathan Mayberry Productions, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Originals, LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.